you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, friends and neighbors. Happy holidays. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod and welcome to this week's roundtable, where we look back on the big stories of the week with three of Washington's top political reporters. This week brought an unusual show of bipartisanship on the Hill, where Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell agreed on a plan to raise the debt ceiling, even though Lindsey Graham warned that Donald Trump would punish any Republican who voted for it. We also saw an unusual standoff online between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, where Biden warned Putin of serious consequences if Russia invades Ukraine. Donald Trump lost another round in court in his bid to withhold key documents from the January 6th House committee. Hand them over, said the D.C. appeals court. And Washington gave a solemn farewell to warrior, statesman, Senate leader, and presidential candidate Bob Dole. Here to put it all in perspective for us, today's panel, Philip Bump joining us, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Hello, Philip.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Okay. Lauren Burke, host of the Burke File podcast and writer for Black Press USA. Hi, Lauren.
How are you, Bill?
Great, thank you. And John Bennett, editor-in-large of CQ Roll Call, back with us again today. Hello, John.
Hello, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and John, let me start with you because we saw something very unusual in the Capitol Rotunda yesterday. As we speak, family and friends are starting to gather at the National Cathedral for the funeral for Senator Bob Dole. Yesterday, speakers celebrated his civility and bipartisanship. Civility, John, and bipartisanship. Phrases we don't hear much anymore around the U.S. Capitol.
No, we do not. The current era certainly conjures that old saying, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. It was a throwback, at least morning yesterday, as the late senator's casket arrived with all the pomp and circumstance, certainly that he was due. He was injured in war. In his book, he doesn't know if it was a mortar round or something else that injured him. But he carried those injuries for the rest of his life. And certainly, he bucked his own party as he was coming up in the Senate ranks, and then, two-time majority leader. He raised corporate taxes at one point and reached across the aisle on other issues. And that was reflected in the ceremony, the mm-hmm. comments yesterday from, I thought this was interesting. I watched this again last night after the fog of the workday had cleared. And I thought it was really interesting that House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy did not speak at the ceremony in the rotunda. And I rewound it as I was watching it. And it really struck me that he didn't say anything. And this is a Republican leader in McCarthy who is, who really reached out and raised money and tried and has built a bridge to the Freedom Caucus element of his caucus. Those are, of course, the most conservative members of the Republican caucus in the House. And it was clear that McCarthy thought he couldn't say anything about, Bob Dole, a guy who cut mm-hmm. deals with Democrats, and every other congressional leader and the president, Joe Biden, spoke yesterday. And that really, I thought that really stuck out from yesterday with Senator Dole lying in state in the rotunda.
Very interesting. And we'll never know, I guess, whether or not he was invited to speak or chose not to. But that was striking. Philip, in a sense, there was a contradiction in itself, because while they were celebrating bipartisanship, and Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell had, in fact, made this bipartisan deal to lift the debt ceiling this week, Lindsey Graham goes into the Republican caucus reportedly and warned Republican senators if they voted for this deal, Donald Trump would never forgive them.
Yeah, it was obviously there will be books written in the future about Lindsey Graham's sort of change of heart, you know, especially since, say, 2008 to today. I think that he's not incorrect. I mean, we saw there's this report from Axios that was just released about how Donald Trump is furious with Benjamin Netanyahu because Benjamin Netanyahu, as the then head of Israel, one of the United States' strongest allies in the Middle East, had the temerity to congratulate Joe Biden for having won the election last year, right? And that was it. He's done. Like, Donald Trump cuts him off, according to this report. So I think it's true that when Lindsey Graham says Donald Trump will not forgive him, the question that has always been the lingering question for the Republican Party is the extent to which they should worry about it. They have, almost to a person, chosen to worry about it a great deal, generally out of concern for primary threats. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the threat actually is real, of course. And it certainly is a strange argument to make when you're talking about matters of policy.
And Lauren, isn't it true with all the yearning maybe for the good old days that we heard yesterday, that the fact is, the good old days are gone, right? I mean, a Bob Dole or even a Ronald Reagan could not get elected as a Republican nominee today.
Well, right now they're gone. It is interesting to watch when we see these funerals. I went to Colin Powell's funeral for The Guardian, and it was the same sort of thing where you just have this feeling as you're standing there that you're looking at a completely bygone era of politics, even though it's not really wasn't really that far away. It is interesting to think about the fact, as John brought up, that Kevin McCarthy didn't say anything. I suspect the reason for that is that, you know, what would he say? You're talking about somebody who was, we see in Congress now, obviously the World War II generation is gone, the Vietnam generation is gone. Max Cleland passed away recently. Obviously, John McCain passed away over the last few years. And that's replaced with what exactly? It's replaced by a bunch of people who, are branding themselves by posing with guns with their family during Christmas. You know, it just is odd. So I guess it is a bygone era. It is always interesting to see some of the people from that era. Tom Daschle, you know, was sitting in a rotunda, and Chris Dodd, and so many others, and consider that that's gone. But, you never know how the pendulum in politics might swing back again with anything, including bipartisanship. I mean, we did see McConnell interestingly blink on the debt ceiling, which I think, I don't know that anybody was expecting that. But anyway, I do, the points here are well taken about this being sort of watching an era that has passed by.
Right. You mentioned the family photos, the Christmas photos, which raised a lot of stink this week. First, Tom Massey from North Carolina, right?
Right.
And then Lauren Boebert from Colorado. Both of them putting out their family photo of Christmas photos, which, by the way, we sent a press family photo out this week. There were no guns in any of the photos.
Right.
So, John, this is pretty taking the Second Amendment argument, I guess, pretty far. Any repercussions from McCarthy or anybody else for that display of love of guns?
No, nothing. We haven't heard anything from McCarthy. My colleagues at Roll Call set out to try to find any reaction, and young Chris Marquette struck out. There's nothing out there. My same colleague, Chris Marquette, last week, after Lauren Boebert, I guess it was last week, last few weeks, around the long Thanksgiving holiday, of course, referred to Ilhan Omar as a terrorist, suggested that she might have a backpack with a bomb going into the Capitol for votes. Of course, that elevator conversation involving a Capitol police officer never happened. McCarthy and I believe others did force Boebert on that one to call Ilhan Omar, call ostensibly about an apology, which inevitably went poorly, and Omar ended up hanging up on her. But that's about as close as McCarthy is going to get it seems like with these conservatives on disciplining them, he's just not going to do it. He wants to be Speaker that bad. It's that simple. He wants to be Speaker of the House so badly that he will put up with just about anything.
Right. Well, in terms of whether the days of civility and bipartisanship will come back, Matt Gaetz, one of the hardliners, of course, in the House, and one whom Kevin McCarthy is also doing anything he can to keep on his team, Matt Gaetz indicated what we can expect if Republicans were to take back the House, at least on his agenda, in 2022. Here is Congressman Gaetz. Philip, I want you to, we'll go to you after we hear this clip.
The notion that Republicans are going to take control of the House and we're going to hold hands in the warm spring rain with the Democrats and legislate is ludicrous. It's not going to be the days of Paul Ryan and Trey Gowdy and no real oversight and no real subpoenas. It's going to be the days of Jim Jordan and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Dr. Gosar and myself.
Notice, Philip, he's attacking other Republicans, not attacking Democrats.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, I think that obviously he's trying to establish the idea that the Republican Party, as you knew it, is now the Republican Party that is the one that's very focused on these culture war fights. It's very focused on elevating this sort of innate sense of dissent that is obviously animating a lot of what's happening. The idea that you're going to go out of your way to agitate and troll your opponents. The Lauren Boebert comments about Ilhan Omar were to a large extent sort of centered on elevating this idea of, you know, a very particular view of who Ilhan Omar is that's obviously rooted in race and you know, country of origin. All of these sorts of things that really do define to a large extent the Trump era of the Republican Party. You know, what Gaetz is saying there is essentially, yes, we are not going back to the Republican Party that existed before Trump. This is now fully a Trumpian party. Now, look, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, Matt Gaetz, you know, the people he named there are not people who are even now hold a lot of power within the Republican Party. And I think Kevin McCarthy is probably not too unhappy about that. And, you know, the extent to which Gaetz is still in the House by the time they take the majority, I think, is also another question to be answered. But yeah, I mean, this is the rhetoric that they're going to say, look, this is new and we're tough and we're fighting. And, you know, that's sort of been the undercurrent for the past 6 years.
So, Lauren, it's hard to see how this would play. But if you were working for the DNC or preparing ads for the DNC, didn't Matt Gaetz just give you the perfect ad to run in a general election in 2022?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, unfortunately, it's not the DNC that does the best messaging for the Democratic Party. It's the Lincoln Project. So you have that problem. You know, I'm not sure Phil was making the point that with regard to where obviously Democrats and Republicans are headed and whether or not this brand of the party is the brand of the party. I spent the last few months watching Glenn Youngkin up close, and we kept running into Republicans who were more than happy to be voting for somebody that they didn't have to explain and they weren't, you know, outwardly embarrassed by. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that Youngkin was able to keep Donald Trump out of Virginia was a major accomplishment that I think led to his victory. But it's still true, obviously, that you have this right wing of the party that wants to brand tough and wants to brand threats and wants to brand their Christmas family photos with semi-automatic rifles. It's amazing. It's sad to watch. It continues. You know, full disclosure, there's only been four members of the House who are members of the Muslim faith, and I worked for one of them, Andre Carson, as his comms director 7 or 8 years ago for about a year. All of them have been threatened like this at one time or another. Keith Ellison, you famously remember when he was being sworn in, used Thomas Jefferson's Bible, and there was a big statement by a congressman in Virginia against that. I mean, it's something that's so sad to see that the Republican Party can't just make some basic, announcements against basic bigotry by their membership. And the fact that Kevin McCarthy fails to do that is sad. And the fact that he's predicating being Speaker on that is sad.
So former President Donald Trump, bad day yesterday. He's in front of the D.C. Appeals Court. To say that my documents and my phone calls and emails are all privileged, still under executive privilege, the Supreme Court and the D.C. Appeals Court. in a 68-page opinion said, no way, hand them over to the January 6th committee. Philip, this is a pretty huge, significant decision, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that there was little expectation that the decision would be anything but this, that the arguments that were being made by Donald Trump were not seen as being particularly credible, but were instead intended to do one thing that they were successful at, which is slow things down. I mean, it's impossible by now to talk about the January 6th committee without talking about the likelihood, if not the near certainty at this point, the Republicans will regain the House next year, at which point they will, without any ceremony at all, simply spike the January 6th committee. It'll just cease to exist once they have power. And so as such, the clock, which has already been ticking, is ticking much faster. And the extent to which Donald Trump can slow things down by having these lawsuits, or that Steve Bannon can slow things down by, you know, not going to trial for months on his contempt charges, all of these things are targeted at that deadline of January 2023, at which point whatever the January 6th commission has or hasn't done is all they're going to be able to do.
Well, John, they've got 2 weeks, right, where they can appeal. Uh-huh. Donald Trump can appeal, ask the Supreme Court to decide on this. Look, it's impossible to read this court, even this 6-3 court. But this gets to a question of the role of Congress, the power of the presidency, and the power of a former president. Do you think he has a chance at the court? A Supreme Court is what I'm asking.
I definitely think Trump's lawyers have quite the uphill battle, because yesterday the 3-judge panel, they didn't just rule against Trump. They ruled that he had, quote, no basis, end quote, to challenge Biden's ability to say that executive privilege no longer applies to those materials. They said, quote, that both branches agree there is a unique legislative need for these documents, and if they are directly relevant to the committee's inquiry, end quote. That is going to be really tough for Trump's lawyers to completely overturn. We've seen Chief Justice John Roberts join over the years with the liberal justices, but I suspect we're going to get more than just Roberts in a majority upholding what the court did yesterday.
And Lauren, Congresswoman Elaine, you cover Virginia, Luria or Luria?
Luria. Luria.
Elaine Luria. Yesterday, she spoke to the efforts by Mark Meadows and others to, you know, sue the committee or delay, as Philip indicated, and John both, drag it out as long as they can. But her comments indicate that the committee is really getting some serious work done despite those challenges. Here's Congresswoman Luria.
You know, we've talked to hundreds of other witnesses as well. And I'll tell you that, you know, Mark Meadows may have his opinion, but there's many others who are in communications, even in the data that he gave us in those texts and emails, you know, that are painting a very full picture of what people knew ahead of January 6th.
So it sounds like they're getting their job done.
Yeah, it's starting to pick up a little steam. I think, you know, the committee sort of started out as, are they going to use the full power that they have to do this investigation? And now, I think it was, to me, right around the time that they, you know, Steve Bannon was found in contempt and they hauled him in the court, it seemed like that was a little bit of a turning point, because now we're getting all these stories about how people are turning over pertinent information and text messages, et cetera, and so on. So I think a committee that, you know, obviously the game on the other side is to stall, to delay, and to get back into power and use that power to cut off all these investigations. But, you know, that's a year or so away. So it's interesting to see that Benny Thompson and the gang are picking up steam.
Right. Okay, we had a big summit, a virtual summit this week between President Putin and President Putin and President Biden. Let's find out what we can expect out of that and more from our panel after a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod, and then we'll be back with Lauren Burke and John Bennett and Philip Bump. Well, of course, the holiday season is here. Don't have to tell you that. It's a time when we're all looking for something special for someone special in our lives. And let me take advantage of this moment to tell you there is no better gift than a hand-woven scarf by the real talent in our family, and that is my wife, Carol. Carol is an award-winning weaver. She specializes in original rayon, chenille, and bamboo scarves, each one of which she designs and weaves herself. They come in a great variety of colors and patterns, which you can check out on her website for a full look at what's available at carolpressscarves.com. But my advice is do it soon so she can get your scarf in the mail in time for the holidays. Again, that website is carolpressscarves.com. Treat somebody you love or treat yourself with a Carol Press scarf for the holidays, carolpressscarves.com.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Back with today's panel, Lauren Burke joining us, host of the Burke File podcast, Philip Bump, national correspondent for the Washington Post, and John Bennett, editor-in-large for CQ Roll Call. It was a new kind of diplomacy today when Joe Biden sat down for a couple of hours online with Vladimir Putin of Russia. Was the message delivered? Philip, what do we know? What do we hear?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, both sides tend to keep their cards fairly close to their chest, and you know there are statements released which sort of summarize the central question here. I think, you know, in addition to the longstanding effort by Biden to try and figure out what the United States relationship with Russia looks like moving forward, the main issue of the moment, of course, is the apparent threat, according to intelligence experts and the defense community, that Russia is now posing to Ukraine with massing troops at its border. This has been, you know, Joe Biden doesn't need many more things that are headaches for him, but this is potentially a very large one. And it's, you know, I don't think that a televised or rather virtual interaction between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin is going to resolve that tension, given its history and you know, given where it is right now. But, you know, I think Biden needs to at least make sure that people understand that he is having these conversations and trying to press forward in trying to cajole Putin into not taking a drastic action on that front. And, you know, as such, I'm sure the White House would be happy to argue that he made progress in that front. But I don't know. This is one of those things where we'll learn further down the road what, if anything, was accomplished, I think.
John, it's certainly a different approach than when we remember George W. Bush said, "I looked into his eyes," the first time that he met with Putin.
Right.
When Donald Trump basically said, "Yeah, I trust him, right? I trust him over my intelligence agencies." A little more of a hard line from Joe Biden.
I guess it's harder to look into someone's eyes over video chat in the Situation Room. Of course, it's a different approach than Donald Trump, who thought that essentially I after covering that for so long, that he could just charm other world leaders, including Putin, into doing whatever the heck Donald Trump wanted him to do. It seems like he did try that with Putin, of course. We haven't gotten the answer on why Trump pursued Putin to be an ally, really a friend. It seemed like over the years, we still haven't gotten complete transparency on that. So yeah, it was a different approach. I think Philip is right. Biden has to do these things. He has to be seen as at least trying to be tougher on Putin. It was floated from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and other members of Biden's staff that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which of course runs from Russia to Germany, is a leverage point for the U.S. and the West, and sending that signal. We don't know if the new German government is quite on board with this idea, but sending the signal to Putin that if he goes into Ukraine with his military troops, that pipeline, which is a really big deal for Russia, and they need any economic boost they can get right now, that could be subject to, you know, shutting it off or delaying it or otherwise impacting Russia negatively with that. And that is, you know, that's the biggest piece of leverage they got. They floated that this week. And, you know, I think that's good for Biden to be seen as willing to go there.
Yeah, Lauren, let me jump to a little bit of breaking news. We've just learned that the consumer price inflation rose by 6.8% over the 12 months just ended in November, which is the largest in measure, largest increase in inflation in 39 years. This is the last thing that Joe Biden needed to hear today.
Yeah, you can say that again. And we already had Joe Manchin saying that he was worried about inflation as the latest reason as to not vote for Build Back Better. And I'm sure he'll use this news to further that idea, to say the least. Joe Biden probably might want to focus on foreign policy and Putin and economic sanctions, because that might be a more successful playing field for him, particularly, of course, given his career in the Senate as somebody who was focused on foreign policy and obviously served on the committee all those years. But that's the type of statistic that, clearly will be used to halt everything that he's doing in Congress. And not to say that that wouldn't have happened anyway. I mean, still, there's no bill. There's no details on what they're doing now. And there's sort of a big delay game going on, as usual, with these bigger bills. But something like that, I'm sure we'll hear about all day long.
Yeah, Philip, at the same time, there are articles I saw a couple of yesterday saying that we have had the fastest economic recovery ever under Joe Biden. So, what's really going on? And is Biden getting full credit for what has happened?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where there's so many facets to what counts as economic news that it's, you know, one can, however one, you know, holds this particular diamond in the hand, see, you know, glints in whatever direction you're looking, to make up a very bizarre metaphor off the cuff here. But, you know, yeah, I mean, there certainly are indications that the economy has rebounded well. For example, the number of new jobless claims this week was at the lowest point since, I believe,
right,
the late 1960s. We've seen the unemployment rate itself decline pretty rapidly. There are all sorts of signs that the job market is doing extremely well, to the point that people are scrambling to fill jobs. You know, and we keep seeing these reports of school bus drivers, and that you know, you can't even find enough people to drive school buses around, which obviously has potential trickle down.
Or snowplows,
exactly right. Something of concern to us here in the Northeast shortly. So there are these indications that the economy is doing well, but at the same time, you know, people who are not particularly concerned about the, you know, the new jobless numbers are seeing, you know, gas prices rising at the pump, or at least seeing prices higher than they were last year. Apparently, gas prices are now going down. Hopefully that will continue. That gas price, you know, a key component of inflation is energy costs. So there are all these things that make it painful in the moment for people. to have to spend money as well. That you know, obviously makes them look at it through a different lens. And then, of course, you have competing narratives in the media talking about whether the economy is good or bad. So, you know, it is an incredibly complex thing. And one can say, you know, by traditional metrics, the stock market is doing well. Employment, you know, we're making big employment gains. Of course, we're also just sort of filling a hole that was created last year from the pandemic. But at the same time, people are spending more money out of pocket and they're worried, at least conceptually, if not practically, about inflation. You know, that I think is certainly a mixed picture.
So John, on the question of how the media reports on the economy, you know, plus or minus or negative or positive, what got a lot of attention this week was an op-ed in the Washington Post by Dana Milbank. I'm paraphrasing the headline, but if you think the media has been negative on Biden, here's the proof. And he cited a study done by a software analyst looking at over 200,000 articles in 65 news outlets the same period last year for Donald Trump and this year for Joe Biden. And Joe Biden got as bad or if not worse media coverage, more negativity than even Donald Trump did. Is this a real issue for the media? And are people thinking about it, talking about it?
Well, first, full disclosure, the data analyst works for Fiscal Note, which is the parent company of my employer, CQ Roll Call.
Okay.
So I'm going to try to not get myself in too much trouble here and just say that I have a lot of feelings about what Mr. Milbank wrote. I think, you know, as someone who was a one-man White House bureau for the most part for the Trump years, you know, there was a lot of news. Donald Trump would make news when he blinked at times. It was news. He tweeted. He said things in pool sprays. He called us back into the Oval for another pool spray to say something about the thing he said in the pool spray in the Roosevelt Room to try to clean up a tweet he fired off at 6:30. And it was all news. Okay? So we wrote a lot of stories just on the news. And he was the president of the United States. I'm sorry, Mr. Milbank. I didn't elect the guy. The media, there's an argument that we did help elect the guy. Fair enough. But we had to cover the presidency. And he happened to be in the presidency. So we wrote a lot of stories at 12:30 and then wrote another one at 1:30. So I understand how a little bit how data works and running this kind of model. So you're going to get a lot of just straight news stories. Donald Trump said this in the Oval Office after he tweeted this earlier in the day. Now, because Joe Biden ran on a conventional presidency and a, quote, boring presidency, we have more time to do real reporting and write longer stories. And yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Milbank, but Joe Biden's presidency started off, I think, pretty well. He was on a roll, and then June and July happened. It is our responsibility as journalists when whoever is in the presidency, and we wrote plenty of critical stories when Donald Trump's presidency hit a bump in the road or three, and Joe Biden's presidency has hit a bump in the road or three, and we have covered it professionally, and we've covered it through a critical lens, and the fact that Joe Biden is not tweeting right now and calling, you know, Joe Manchin horrible names or Kyrsten Sinema horrible names because they won't give him exactly what he wants. And that's what Donald Trump did so many mornings to Republicans. Yeah. There's not as many of those little stories to write.
Well, I look forward to getting you and Dana Milbank on a future podcast to continue that conversation. But Lauren, you've written about some of the negative coverage of Kamala Harris, which has been particularly noteworthy these last few weeks.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a double standard there, huge double standard. I don't think anybody can name another vice president who's been covered as specifically with regard to her behavior and her way she treats her staff. And all of a sudden, Kamala Harris shows up and we get all these types of stories, which, by the way, I'd have absolutely no problem with if I could find the same stories reported on, you know, on Mike Pence or something like or Dick Cheney, which, of course, you can't. I actually think that there's some validity to that reporting, by the way. It has been said that she's not a particularly easy person to work for, but that would make her no different than a million other people in politics. So then you have to ask the question, why is she the one, you know, reported on this way? I mean, the media has been completely changed, and nobody's really studied it, by the advent of social media, Twitter and Facebook in particular. The speed of things is lightning right now. It used to be that the media cycle was 24 hours, and now, of course, it's not. There is no media cycle. It's every minute that somebody tweets something that somebody has to then write about. And the fact is that Donald Trump is money. Donald Trump is money. The clicks, the way that money is built in the media now is through clicks to ads. And Donald Trump was driving all of that train. And that's part of the reason why I think we see, you know, different reporting on Joe Biden than we did Trump. And quite frankly, you know, Biden did very well. It wasn't just that he did okay. I mean, he basically corralled a crisis that has killed 700,000 people in this country. They passed the Rescue Act, the CARES Act. That was big stuff. Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy. He's a genuine crisis to our democracy. And for that reason alone, he should be considered different to cover than Joe Biden. So I thought what Dana Milbank laid out was quite interesting from a lot of different angles. This subject obviously in itself is a podcast. And it's something that goes deep.
Philip, you want to weigh in there with a final word on the media today and whether it's treating Biden fairly or deserves some of this criticism?
Sure. I mean, I have the alternate, either the sort of the flip side conflict here, since Dana Milbank obviously works for the Washington Post. No one in the media doesn't have a strong opinion on this. I think that's safe to say. And, you know, I, who do a lot of work on data, I have questions about sentiment analysis. You know, when you pick out the word good in a sentence, you know, what does that actually mean about what the sentence is trying to say? I mean, these are the sorts of things that go into this analysis, you know, but not to get too into the weeds on that. I mean, I think that it is the case that there is enough that is reported on a daily basis that I appreciate that what Dana tried to do is take a big picture lens to this and say, okay, let's look at all of this. Because usually what we hear is people cherry pick stories that they don't like or stories that they think are you know, egregiously stupid, which, you know, happens a lot. And then they say, oh, look, this is what the media is doing. And of course, one can cherry pick anything you want to prove a point. That's the sort of thing we usually see. And that, I think, is very frustrating to members of the media. Dana at least went big picture. I still think there's probably some questions about, you know, the conclusions that he drew from it. But I will at least give a thumbs up to that.
All right. To be continued. And, you know, there are going to be books written on the media coverage of Donald Trump and Joe Biden and comparing the two for sure. Great conversation. We touched just about everything that happened this week, except your favorite story of the week. And what among all the things that we cover, and as busy as we are running fast, there's always one story that stops you in your tracks and says, oh, how about this? This is interesting or funny or serious or sad. Lauren, you want to start us off?
Sure. It wasn't my favorite story, but I just wanted to use this moment to talk about Fred Hyatt.
Oh, yeah.
In another life, about 2 years ago, I was talking to Fred Hyatt quite a lot about someone I was consulting in communications, and that would be the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Justin Fairfax. And frankly, at a time when the media is really reporting a very one-sided view, in my view, of Me Too stories, Fred Hyatt and the Washington Post editorial board actually listened to Justin Fairfax, who nobody was listening to, absolutely nobody. And Fred Hyatt sat on a Zoom call with the Lieutenant Governor for about an hour, doing something that nobody else in journalism was doing at the time, which was just listening. And there was a editorial that resulted from that, which I think changed the direction of the story. So because of that, I would never have guessed that I'd be talking about Fred Hyatt passing away this week. But I just wanted to mention him because as somebody who's been in journalism for over 20 years and has consulted a few people and had to sort of deal with this issue from both sides, watching things from both sides, he showed me something there that I was very surprised to see and that nobody else was doing, which is just listening to another side of the story that everybody else had decided was done and writing something on it.
I'm glad you raised that. He certainly was a champion of journalism at its best, for sure. John, what caught your attention?
Well, I recently on the show broke my streak of
sports stories.
Talk a little bit about sports, but let's make this two in a row and keep the streak alive. I was fascinated earlier this week and over last weekend by the college football coaching carousel and the drama that has become coaching. Steve Zabin, who used to be on sports radio here in D.C., he's always said that the NFL is a television show about quarterbacks. And I, especially this year, have piggybacked off that. College football is becoming a television show about coaches. And we really saw that. The Miami Hurricanes have had a disappointing season. Their head coach, Manny Diaz, came in, I think, 3 years ago, and there were high hopes. A young coach, they thought he would be able to recruit and turn that program around. It just hasn't worked out that way. So after their season finale, the worst-kept secret in college football was that university officials and the big boosters down in South Beach were courting then-Oregon head coach Mario Cristobal. And, you know, numbers were out there. Contract terms were really public and being reported. So you had a situation Monday morning as the university and Mario Cristobal were finalizing their deal where Coach Diaz was actually out recruiting. He found out that he was relieved of his duties while he was out recruiting for the football team that he now no longer coaches. You know, nobody is too sad for these big coaches. They have huge multi-million dollar buyouts. Oh, yeah. But that is where we are in college football, that you can be sitting in a recruit's living room and get a text message that you're fired.
There were several generals, I think, who got text messages from Donald Trump that they were fired.
You're right.
Philip Bump, your favorite story?
Sure, I would first of all just piggyback. You know, if I'm sitting in the room and I get that text message, I'm like, you know what? Actually, maybe you don't want to come to school after all. I feel like that's your pretty natural next step. Yeah, I mean, my story. I mean, not to be too trite, but I this story of the tree burning outside of the Fox News in New York City.
Yes.
You know, not the story itself, which, you know, I mean, look, you know, anyone who's lived in New York City knows you have random weirdos who do weird things, and, you know, sometimes bad things can result. Arson is bad. I will stipulate that. But the reaction from Fox News just so wildly over the top and so deeply in contrast to how they covered, or how many of the people on the network covered the January 6th riot. And he's just, framing this as just this sign of the decay of civilization and this war against Fox News and this melodramatic relighting ceremony they had last night. I mean, it's just so over the top in an extremely on-brand Fox News way. One can't help but contrast it with how
wait a minute, Philip, how can you say that? I mean, here is Ansley Earhart of Fox and Friends putting this whole thing in perspective.
The tree that unites us, that brings us together, it's about the Christmas spirit, it is about the holiday season, it's about Jesus, it's about Hanukkah, it is about everything that we stand for as a country, freedom.
It is, I mean, if there's one thing we can say, it's the Christmas tree at Fox News is about Hanukkah. I think we can all agree on that.
This was like their January 6th, right? I mean, it was the big story of the day on Fox. It was the lead story on Hannity and Tucker that night, right? That was so amusing. Well, my big story of the week, it was out in Houston, Texas. I have always had this debate with friends and with my former producer. I'm not talking about Jay Feldman here, but my former producer, about what you do if you found money. If you find money, do you call the cops? Do you report it or not? We had a very feel-good story about that this week when a plumber whose name is Justin Cawley, was called in to repair a toilet in the Lakewood Country Church. That's the mega church of big mega preacher Joel Osteen. And he removed some tile, as we know, in the bathroom and back of the toilet and found a bag containing 500 envelopes full of checks and cash. We don't know exactly how much money was in it, but It seems to be related to a theft of $600,000 from the church safe back in 2014. That money was never found. The investigation was still underway. I think the investigation is over. And the first thing that Mr. Cawley did was he called the cops and said, I found all this money. What do I do? For his goodness and good citizenship, he received a $20,000 reward this week from the Crime Stoppers of Houston. So I salute Mr. Cawley, and I hope I would have made the same decision he did. But one is never sure, right? Particularly when you find that much money. Oh, my gosh. And anyway, hey, thanks so much to today's panelists. Thank you, Philip Bump. Thank you, Lauren Burke. Thank you, John Bennett. Hey, before we go, we always get this question from listeners. How do people keep up with you? John, where do they find you and can follow you?
They can find me on Twitter at BennettJohnT.
At BennettJohnT. How about you, Lauren?
At LV Burke, LVBURKE on Twitter.
And you want to say a word about your podcast too?
Sure. The podcast link is on my Twitter bio. It is called Burke File. And, you know, I've been doing it for about 2 years, but, you know, I can't say I'm alone. Everybody's got a podcast.
And Philip Bump, you have a new newsletter. Tell us about it.
I do. Speaking of things that everybody has, I just launched a newsletter this week called How to Read This Chart. And basically, it takes a look every week at an interesting data visualization that is related to the news and sort of digs through it and what it shows and how it tells the story, which I hope will be interesting to folks. And then, of course, I'm on Twitter at PBump.
All right. Thank you all. And thank you, everybody, for listening today. Speaking of podcasts, of course, there's this one, Bill Press Pod. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. Just wherever you go to listen to your podcast, pull up the Bill Press Pod and subscribe. It's fast and it's easy. And then you are a regular member. We'll be back next week with the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Wear that mask. Go out and get your booster if you haven't already done so. And we'll see you next week on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.